From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today, we're again featuring two interviews from our program library. Who can forget those early hours of Desert Storm when the only news out of Baghdad was the haunting voice of reporter Peter Arnett? CNN's Dick Tauber tells us how hand-taped battery packs, spliced lines, last-minute deals, and a circuitous route all contributed to getting the story of a city under attack out to the world. Also, Peter Neumann. As principal scientist at SRI International, Peter specializes in analyzing problems found in technology systems. We talk about the state of American technology, and in particular, we talk about the avoidable problem with the Patriot Defense System, which permitted an Iraqi Scud missile to tragically fall on a Marine barracks in Tehran. We all vividly recall seeing on our television screens pictures of the Allied attack on the city of Baghdad. Cable News Network was there at the very beginning, bringing back the sights and sounds of war. One of the people responsible for making that happen is Dick Tauber. He's director of satellites and circuits for CNN. I asked Dick just how difficult it was preparing for coverage of a war.
We had spent a lot of time planning how we were going to cover, you know, what was going on in Saudi Arabia, what was going to go on in Jordan or
this
Israel.
This is during the Desert Shield portion.
Yeah, this was after August 2nd when the Iraqis went into Kuwait. We began. That was a very hectic time, very, very hectic for about the first 3 weeks when nobody knew, you know, what was going to happen from a moment to moment. So it was like a crash course and get ready for something somewhere. You know, and that's not easy in our business because we got wires and things and boxes and all this stuff has to be in place, and you can't. There's no magic to this. You know, there's no magic to this business. You got to have people there. You got to have them ready. You got to have cameras. You got, you know, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of things that have to be moved around in order to do coverage. So a whole lot happened very quickly in like August and beginning of September. And then there was this kind of, you know, standing off position between the two sides, and eventually through the UN you got to the January 15th deadline. And then we had actual, like, months of time where we knew unless something unexpected or unplanned happened, we were going to be okay.
Now, where was CNN prior to, say, January 15th? Where were you placed over there? Baghdad, clearly.
No, well, we had crews there, and we were using Iraqi TV to transmit through their facilities to get news out on from time to time. We did not have an earth station, a portable earth station, moved into Baghdad yet because we hadn't been given permission. We had a unit in Amman, which was waiting to go if and when the Iraqi government or the Ministry of Communications said, yeah, okay, you can come now. And that eventually came down to a point of they're telling us, if we can't do it for you, then you can bring your stuff, but not until then. And not until then was, you know, when the bombs started falling and they essentially wiped out a lot of stuff is bombed, and that included the TV center. And you got to think about this. Iraq TV, their headquarters and their operation in Baghdad, is like a single local TV station in your community.
One of them.
And that's it for the whole country. They had some branch stuff, but basically the main operation was in Baghdad, and there was an earth station not too far from there, which is where we could uplink to a satellite that could get us to, essentially, we uplinked back to Jordan, where we were based, and then used another one of our flyaway portable earth stations out of Amman to transmit back to the U.S. And that was another piece of the whole plan that was put into place fairly early in the game. We originally went to Cairo with that unit to cover some temporary talks that took place but went nowhere there, and then moved that with the permission of the Jordanian government into Amman. About the same time that the troops got deployed, there was another thing that happened called the DOD, or Department of Defense Pool. And this is something that was worked out with the networks in the U.S. some time ago, because in like Granada. Remember Granada?
Oh, yeah.
When that happened, the U.S. networks got in, kind of upset with the whole military operation because they wanted to get in there and cover what was happening with that war, and we weren't permitted to go in right away or soon enough. So sometime after that, there was some discussions with the Pentagon and what have you, and they kind of worked out something called the DOD pool. And that meant that in some kind of rotation, one of the networks, meaning ABC, CBS, NBC, or CNN, would be notified that it was now their turn and a DOD pool was being declared. And that meant we would get help to move our equipment and crews with the deployment. That meant we would be there. And then with whatever restrictions were being put on us on the ground, we could then go and cover the event. Well, so CNN was pool. It was our turn to be pool. So we went off into what was then, you couldn't say Dhahran, you know, for a while. That was, it was like
Eastern
Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
You know, and then it became, yeah, Dhahran. Somebody said Dhahran, and then it was, oh, yeah, you mean Dhahran. So we were off with essentially the first deployment of ground forces into the Dhahran area. And so we had a unit there that was a pool unit, and eventually we added another one of our own CNN unilateral units because the fact that pool was moving forward, there was this sharing operation going on. We still had our own plans for the kind of coverage we needed for CNN, and we needed to be able to have a path, a transmission route for ourselves.
Now, you had equipment on the ground to record, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you also had one of these flyaways?
Okay, flyaway is a portable earth station. They come in a couple of sizes, like a 1.8 meter or 2.4 meter. That's about the size of a patio umbrella, you know, size by the time you put it all together.
Uh-huh.
But the trick about flyaway, why it's a flyaway, is that all the bits and pieces and the boxes and the electronic this and the scope that and the monitoring this and all the various pieces that go together come in cases which meet the height, width, depth, and weight restrictions for airline excess baggage. But it's a flyaway because you can fly it away, and that means you can put it on an airplane. It goes with your crew, it goes with your reporter, it goes with your producer, it goes with the engineers, and they all get there at the same time. They all get into a truck, and they pack up these boxes, and they all go to where the story is, and they do it all at the same time. So it's a tremendous savings in manpower and time in terms of our ability to get to a story and send pictures back. And so that's a flyaway, and we eventually had 5 of those in the Middle East during the war. 2 in Dhahran, including the pool unit, 1 in Riyadh, 1 in Amman, and eventually 1 in Baghdad. And at one point, then later on, after the Desert Storm started and Kuwait was liberated, we moved one of the Riyadh-ish, we took down and moved that into Kuwait. Now, all of this is a lot of moving of things and pieces and stuff. It also means that you got to meet whatever regulations exist in the country you want to operate, and that can be both easy or very, very difficult, depending on who you're dealing with. And it can be inexpensive or it can be very, very, very expensive. It depends. It depends on the country. And it still does, right to this day. I mean, still deploying these things around the world. And the networks all have them. Or we either rent them or we have our own. And depending on where you want to go. Now, it was interesting. In Somalia, we had 2 in Somalia. We still have 1 there. And I think we're the CNN is the only crew that's still operating there. But that problem was, you know, who do you go to get permission? There was no one to go to. In fact, we tend to transmit all this video usually, at least during the war, 95% of what we did was through what they call the INTELSAT. It's the International Telecommunications Satellite Organization, the satellites that are used for worldwide inter-country, cross-ocean telecommunications of all sorts, you know, video, telephone traffic, data, you know, computer type stuff. And most of the leases that we set up for short-term use of satellite time were done through the Inelsat system. And Inelsat insists that before you can actually send 1 inch of video, you have to send them and show that you have formal, written, signed, sealed, and delivered permission from the country you're going to be operating from, or you can't come up. They will not authorize the Earth station system in the various countries you want to deal with to get up or down. They won't let you do the down part.
Who controls Intelsat?
Intelsat is controlled by its members. Its members are essentially the various telecommunications administrations country by country around the world. That used to be the easy answer, only it's not true anymore because some of the people who do it now are a group within a group who have been set off here and say, okay, you'll deal with all these signatory things that have to do with rules and regs of Intelsat and paying of bills and all of that. But the people who will operate the telecommunications administration in this country now will be these guys over here, and they're a private company now. They've just become a private company, so they're on a pay-as-you-go basis, and they have to talk to you about getting these arrangements done. It's becoming much more complicated as privatization and liberalization of a lot of telecommunications law is changing throughout the world. So, for example, in Saudi Arabia, it's probably still the ministry in the same old basic structure that they've generally had for a long time. And in other countries, it's more like that than not.
Through Desert Shield, every network and numerous correspondents were positioned there. And yet when Desert Shield became Desert Storm, when the bombs first started falling on Baghdad, it was only the voice of CNN we heard.
Yes, voice. Not pictures, at least for numbers of days. It was essentially a very old kind of technology that we put that was in place. Something called it was a four wire, old fashioned private line, four wire, no signaling. You know, that started at the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. And went up to, through, I think, a microwave system, because I've tried to trace this out, how it actually all really happened, but I suspect it was put into place and it worked, I know that. a four-wire is like a private phone line that goes into like a little voice box, you know, and you push a button and you go, hello, is Frank there? And you let go of the button and Frank goes, yeah, here I am, and then you back and forth, you talk to each other. We had been trying to get something like this into Baghdad, one, because the telecommunications infrastructure in Iraq was not great anyway, but also as a security measure to know that we would have an open line if there was a problem. And our folks on the ground there had been talking about this for months. And as soon as things started there, and as soon as we had people there, we started in August to talk about it. This is something we wanted. At one point, I had gone over to Amman to try to work out some of the financial dealings that we had in Jordan, and we were dealing with their telecommunications, their post-telecom and telegraph agency, the one who controlled all of that for their country. At one point, I was at the hotel where we were based, and I got a phone call, and they said, well, you have to go over to this other hotel and meet at the ABC location where they're working. So I raced in a taxi over to this meeting and sat down, and this guy started talking about private line charges. Wait a second. This is like four wires. I wanted to talk about the charges for the Earth station and the uplinking and all that. And he said, oh, no, I don't do that. I'm in charge of private lines. Here's what we've decided. How many do you want? Well, I got in touch with Atlanta, and they said, well, let's get one, you know, right now. And so we ordered that, and very, very quickly, the Jordanian telecom group got this line working from Amman between Amman and Atlanta. It was like a matter of days. We had this up and running. The price was reasonable for this kind of circuit, full-time circuit, you know, which you're not sharing with anybody. And what one of the head of our international desk says, you know, we've been talking to the folks in Baghdad about getting a four-wire between Baghdad and Atlanta. Maybe the guys in Jordan, maybe they can help us get a line from Amman to Baghdad. So we did that. We placed another order saying, look, can you talk to your friends in Baghdad? Tell them we just want to go Amman, Baghdad, Baghdad, Amman. Can you do that? Okay, we'll try. You know, so our guys in Baghdad start talking, can we do it now? Maybe we can do this one this way. They said yes. So we got the circuit hooked up from the Al Rashid back to, essentially it was the Philadelphia Hotel where we were based in Amman. And we had a bright engineer on the ground there. I said, you know, if I take these two wires here and I take these two and I go like this and put them together, we can actually talk from Baghdad to Atlanta and back the other way. Of course, we'll hear all this in Amman and we can jump in and out from Amman, but they'll be connected. And that's what we did.
Don't tell anybody.
Well, it wasn't even a question of telling. I mean, we essentially got what we ordered, and I think we ended up having ordered it in a way that made it doable. I mean, I know, yeah. For example, one of the networks was trying to order a four-wire from, I think, New York, between New York and Baghdad. Fat chance, you know. It wasn't there. It was from Duran to Baghdad, between those two. There was no way that was going to happen. I mean, I know that. I think they knew that. And they were trying to do what we were trying to do. I think we had some advantages in Baghdad. For one, we went in on the very beginning, and we stayed there from the very beginning. We always had people in Baghdad. We had, you know, and we had rotating people going in and out, getting, you know, coming out for some R&R. Just to get a breather, and then they'd go back. The people who were there would come out, and they'd be trading back and forth.
It was
the same,
a presence.
But it was yeah, it was always a presence from the very beginning, all during the desert shield buildup, and then eventually even in through Desert Storm. And it was the same people. They got to know these people. Got to know the people they were dealing with on the other side. I cannot say that was true for the other networks because they had, for certain things, it's like I think. You know, one of the main evening newscasters went in for one network or another network, and their producers went in and their people went in, and they did what they had to do to make arrangements. And that was not an easy thing to do there. That was a hard, long, time-consuming thing to do. Well, having that presence there for the amount of time that we did, I think, was really played in our favor. And it finally, it wasn't like wearing anybody down. It was like, you know, when you tell somebody enough times, you say, you know, we need this. We really need this in order to make sure our coverage happens and that we can do it. The other thing that was an advantage, I think, for CNN is that they knew and we knew that we were going around the world, that what we were getting from Baghdad would be seen, you know, in 155 countries around the world. And that was then. Now we're in like 200 and some odd. But that was an incentive. It was a major incentive, this whole thing, telediplomacy, you know, and all these things that started to come up as a result of the war and the way we began to be characterized and the high profile that CNN began to, you know, CNN plays a part, you know, and, you know, Bush makes a statement in Kennebunkport and Ozil goes and answers the phone in Turkey, you know. Those kinds of stories all began to surface, and it was just very, very high presence, high profile for what we were doing.
My guest today is Dick Tauber, Director of Satellites and Circuits for CNN. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now let me ask you, when the four wire was hooked up into the hotel in Baghdad,
mm-hmm.
Where did it go into? Did it go into a room?
It went into a room, and it went into essentially a small box, about 6x6x6 box with a speaker in it and a push-to-talk button and a microphone. And that went into, and there was a little power inside. You plugged it into AC outlet in the wall. During the bombing, when the power went out and the lights went out, they were running it through a battery pack, camera battery pack. You know, one of the reasons why, you know, I don't know if what was going on in the very, very beginning, but there was a time where we lost contact.
Yes.
It's because the power went out. Somebody had to literally do a splice job on the end of a AC connector. They had to cut the plug off, take it and twist it around a couple of battery twist-down connectors so that we could connect it to the battery pack so that we had a way of powering this little box so that you could push the talk and have contact.
So you could push the talk to eventually get all the way back to Atlanta.
And that was a convoluted thing. I mean, it was microwave and then probably went to satellites over the Atlantic Ocean and then went into a voice center in New York, outside New York, where it then was piped into, you know, terrestrial lines that, you know, just like a regular phone line traffic and goes all the way down to Atlanta and it gets to their point there and then it comes over to CNN.
One thing that I do remember very distinctly about watching the and listening to the coverage on the Persian Gulf War was at some point it became clear that Saddam Hussein was watching CNN.
Oh, yeah.
How did we find that out?
Well, I guess we knew it. I mean, we had people who would go to the ministry offices, you know, where these are people who, in one way or another, either them or their bosses were advising Saddam, and these are the people you had to get the permissions for this, and they, you know, can I go over there and talk to these people about such and such? And they would say, absolutely not. So you go back the next day and say, can I go over there and talk to these people about this? Well, maybe. Come back tomorrow. You know, and so our guys on the ground were very, very good and very hardworking, and they were relentless about getting us the permissions to do what we needed. Well, you go into these offices enough, and these people would come out and talk to you about what was on CNN. I don't think CNN was available countrywide. It's not like, you know, you can turn it on in your hotel room, you know, in Baghdad. But we knew that, you know, within the governmental structure, and this is true in a lot of countries, that we know the governmental structure, the main people in those high offices have access to this. Sometimes they have people who they pay to do nothing but translate it from English to whatever the native language is, and then do summaries of some of the things that are reported, particularly things about what was happening, you know, like with the president, you know. And we know it's like in terms of like when Clinton stepped in and Bush left, you know, we know there's a little flurry of activity there because this is a major change within this country, but it will eventually have an impact around the world. So we know that that happens. We know how that happens. That's also part of this heritage from the war that's come up because it's put a burden on us too. I mean, it's like an albatross around our necks. We have to be there now. We have to have a presence. We can't not cover a story. You know, we have to have instantaneous coverage of what happens. You know, when the verdict in the King trial comes in Los Angeles, we have to continue to get all those reports out of Yugoslavia and different areas of and Bosnia and Herzegovina and what's happening over there. We have to report on what's going on the West Bank. We have to report on what's happening, you know, in Waco, no matter how tragic it may eventually be. It's a, you know, but and we have to be there the moment it happens. We can't. The delay is like, it hurts us. It hurts us professionally now in a way that it didn't used to. I mean, when I started at CNN, I used to sometimes struggle for hours and hours waiting for, you know, when will we get that first piece of video? You know, well, now we have to presuppose what the events are going to be and make sure that we're ready. And that's a burden. It's a financial burden because those things cost money. All those satellites and fibers and all that stuff I talk about, that all has dollar signs attached to it. You know, all we keep track of record of how we route a feed, any feed, whatever it is. We put little hyphens in between different pieces of whatever element. This is a microwave, and this is a fiber, and this is a satellite uplink, and this is a transponder space segment on this satellite over here, and this is where all these hyphens going on. All those are like dollar signs. They're great big dollar signs all between those things, and it all comes out. I mean, we spend from $5,000 to $50,000 a day on transmission costs, depending on what we're doing, and sometimes more than that, depending on what the event is and the story. So
has that changed your plan? I mean, the Gulf War came along. Boy, you guys powered up to do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we did.
And
fortunately, we had behind us the whole the whole structure of CNN and TBS and, you know, we have had our new president, he's not new now, but Tom Johnson started working. His first day on the job was August 1st, 1990. And he came in to kind of say hi to everybody in the newsroom.
Where's Kuwait?
Bam, you know. It's like he did, that was like, you have 32 more seconds to take a deep breath, and then you can just run like hell for the next 6 months. And literally that was, I mean, he used to be the editor, Tom Johnson used to be editor of the L.A. Times. And he says, you know, they're used to sometimes someone come in with a problem and you maybe have some days to think about it and decide how you want to handle it. You know, CNN, 10 minutes, if you're lucky. And these are very sometimes cost-sensitive, very expensive decisions you have to make, and you have to make them right now.
We've just been talking about the enormous cost of you know, bringing in all this equipment suddenly into the Persian Gulf theater of operation.
Yeah.
How much did that end up costing unexpectedly that you clearly didn't have in your budget?
Well, no, you're right. Wasn't in the budget.
it was not in the budget.
It was approved, and I give credit to my bosses and the people who make the decisions about how we do our business for essentially, you know, biting the bullet and saying we will do our very best. And yeah, we know it's going to cost a lot, but we will do our very, very best to make sure we cover this from top to bottom. And I just am aware that at least on the night that the bullets started flying, there was about a 4.5 hour time period there where we were making phone calls, myself and my staff, and with the counseling and direction from the news editors who were responsible for all this money, where we were making financial decisions, committing ourselves to this, committing ourselves to that, where I think we, within about a 4 or 5 hour time block, we had committed to about $11 million worth of costs. Just in that. Now, some of that was for something that would last 3 months, some of it would last a week, some of it would last a month and a half, but it was like major.
You're making deals.
Making deals. And actually, we'd pre-program the deals, you know.
Yeah.
This is finally saying, remember that deal? Yes. Now. And I don't mean later, I mean like now, you know. Actually, there was one of the guys who works with me had spent months negotiating some stuff with the British Telecom about, well, this lease and these uplinking, and instead of part-time, it'll be 24 hours a day, and we'll do this, and then we'll do that, and all this stuff. And it had a fairly hefty price tag to it by the time it was all put together. And he had written a memo to me and to the head of the international news and said, this is what we could do, and this is what it will cost. And the head of the news had written a note on the top of the memo that said, this is outrageous. Does it have to cost this much? Can't we do better? Well, on January 16th, I took this memo and I walked around to where he was stationed. I said, remember this? You know, if we want to do any of this other stuff, we've got to do this thing. So, yeah. You know, it was like, forget that. Do it now. Make it happen. You know, it was like, we can't argue about this anymore. So, yeah, and some of that is a bit of play, and I'm exaggerating a little what happened, but there was some crucial decision-making that had also been preceded by a tremendous amount of thought and planning about what we would do, about where we would have stations, knowing the news guys knew who the crews would be, where they would be, we knew where the station would be, what engineers were going to be there, when they would be there, or if they were already there, you know, what satellites we would use, which way they would be pointed, what direction they would go, how we would get it back to Atlanta, you know, all of that. And we've been working on that for months.
Dick Tauber is Director of Satellites and Circuits at CNN. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. what happens when technology doesn't work? Peter Neumann studies the problems of technology in his monthly column, Inside Risks. I asked Peter his opinion of the state of American software.
The state of software as a whole, whether it's European or Japanese or American, is not really what it ought to be. There's an enormous difference between writing a little program for a PC, maybe a little query by example thing, or maybe it's a little spreadsheet program on one hand, and writing a system with maybe 10 million lines of code or 60 million lines of code or something on that order of magnitude that is going to be responsible for maintaining the health and safety of a very large number of individuals, or that is going to be responsible for keeping a large amount of information in a reasonable state. That means secure, reliable, high integrity, that the data is actually correct. And when you're building a system that has very critical requirements, the name of the game is totally different from that which one runs into when one is merely writing a little PC program.
So it doesn't matter if you're writing a simple PC program that has some nice small side effect like producing a little mailing list for you so you don't have to do that every month versus the kind of programming that's life critical.
That's partly true. And then there's also the question of what is this computer system doing? We have a bunch of stories of mailing list programs that either failed and produced horrendous mistakes in addressing, or that were in fact compromised. There are two stories of congressional computer systems that were broken into from outside, and the labeling system was altered rather radically, and the mailing lists were destroyed. So again, it's not just a question of does it work right, but does it work right in the face of malicious attacks, in the case of the mailing label things? Does it work right in the face of normal problems with the hardware failing? Does it work properly in certain critical environments where you might have lightning strikes or power failures, in a hospital environment where if the system goes down, you're going to lose a lot of patients, if in fact they are connected in a life-critical way?
Well, given that, how do we tell how good the software is or the system is?
Now I think you've hit the real nub of the problem. There is no real way to guarantee that the system is any good. We have examples of systems that have gone on for 6, 7, 8, 9 years with no major disasters, and all of a sudden a line of code that was written years ago is suddenly executed, and that line of code might never have been executed before because something unusual happened. And the problem is that we have to anticipate all of the unusual circumstances that might arise. And the average programmer is never oriented toward doing that. The person who is writing, say, software for a fly-by-wire aircraft system might worry a lot more about that. If what happens if this system suddenly gets into a funny state, what will happen to the aircraft? Where there are a lot of lives at stake. And the problem is, how do you know that that system will do what it's supposed to do essentially all of the time? The answer is, you can't. And there are all sorts of things that we can do in the computer profession, in better methodologies for software development, and in testing, and in diagnosis, and in maintenance properties, and operational routines for carrying out, software maintenance in some sane way. Because every time you change a line of code, you have potentially undermined the entire system, as was shown in the case of the telephone system collapse when a 3-line code patch was put in that hadn't been tested thoroughly. Now, even if you have tested it thoroughly, you still don't know that it's going to do the right thing. And in the research community, there's all sorts of work on formal methods and sort of mathematical proofs of correctness, which can, in fact, in certain cases, greatly increase your assurance that the system will do the right thing. But the bottom line is that you will never know that the system will do the right thing.
Yeah. It will likely do the right thing. after all these exercises, but you just don't know environmentally what's going to happen.
That's right.
Software and computers are viewed as these black boxes, and I remember decades ago I sat in front of my family's little black and white TV inside a very large mahogany cabinet, I like to point out, and with great anticipation we watched the countdown of an unmanned rocket, but it was wonderful. And seconds before ignition, the countdown stopped, and Walter Cronkite looked sort of alarmed. And then he listened in his earpiece, and he said in that, you know, so recognizable Walter Cronkite voice, we were all looking, and he said, apparently the computer broke. Now, while this was long before I had anything to do with computers, it wasn't very satisfying. I mean, I wanted to know what happened. You know, did the lights go out? Did the doors fall off? You know, what does that mean, the computer broke? But getting back to the black box magic aspect, should an everyday person expect that an explanation can be made and that it's an explanation they can understand when they hear about these failures?
I don't think so. if you go back to the very first shuttle launch,
yeah,
there was this timing glitch in the software where the backup system was not synchronized properly with the primary four computers, and it's something that had worked always in all the testing that they'd ever done before that. It took them quite a while to analyze the thing and figure out what had gone wrong, because it wasn't at all obvious. In some cases, it takes days to figure out what the problem was. In some cases, it's immediately obvious because the programmer is sitting there and he suddenly realizes that he forgot a character or a sign or something like that, an inversion maybe. And he'll slap his head hard and say, wow, I forgot. Boy, I really goofed that one.
That decimal point.
But in many cases, the nature of the problem is so subtle on the face of it that it takes quite a while to find it.
I remember when there was the problem with the Hubble telescope. And one thing that really impressed me is I was listening to my public radio station, and there was a live broadcast of speeches being made in Congress at that point. And one congressman after another got up and indignantly said, how could they do this, and I can't believe, and you know. And yet I didn't hear one person standing up who seemed to have any comprehension of how technology was developed. And yet we depend on them to make the right choices and to ensure that the right amount of money is provided to the right systems people to make sure that this happens. The space program goes forward, technology goes forward. How much does a person in Congress need to know to understand the situation?
Well, let's generalize it to people outside of Congress as well as people inside of Congress. What's happening is that in order to survive in this world, you need a great deal of technological literacy. The concept of the black box that you've alluded to is sort of a concept of virtual reality where everything just works fine and you don't have to worry what's inside the black box. In order to realize why you have a problem, you need to understand how the system works. If there's a credit card problem, you have to understand why they are telling you that, I'm sorry, the computer can't do this. It is not that the computer can't do it, it's that just somebody either doesn't know how to do it or that the program ignored that particular case, but it could easily have done it had it been programmed properly. So there are many issues here that require a great deal of understanding and knowledge and experience, and perhaps your program is heading in that direction. But I think as far as Congress is concerned, if they have the attitude that they can treat everything as a black box, they're in real trouble, because they simply cannot understand the depth of the problems without having been exposed to them. As we walk through, for example, the years and years of disasters that have occurred in dealing with computers, we see that the same kinds of mistakes are made over and over again in somewhat different contexts. But the people who did the original system are no longer around. One of the problems when you're dealing with a system with 10 million lines of code is that you never want to do it again. And a lot of the people who have been through an effort like that simply go off and do other things with their lives, so that some of the lessons that have been gained get lost. Another thing is that there's a wonderful book by Henry Petrosky, who's a civil engineer at Duke, To Engineer is Human. And he talks about how we don't ever learn anything from our successes, but we have an opportunity to learn from our failures. So it's very important to really take a look at the failures and figure out what's happened. And I think Congress sort of assumes in the abstract that computers are black boxes and communication systems are black boxes and they should work properly. But in fact, they don't.
They don't.
And we really have to spend a lot more effort in figuring out why they don't work the way they're supposed to.
What are the different stages in developing technology where errors or potential failures can get introduced?
Oh, this is an enormous range. The first thing is deciding on whether you really should put a computer in the system or not. In the nuclear power, for example, the system is fairly complicated, but I think a lot of the people in the field have felt that putting a computer in line in the control would make it even less reliable. So the modern systems tend to use computers for the automatic shutdown system, but not necessarily for the control systems themselves. And so the first decision is, should you really put a computer into a particular application? If you do, what have you done to the situation? Have you suddenly created a problem for yourself that if the computer should fail, you do not have a fail-safe mode in your design, and you might kill a very large number of people? The second thing is, of course, is once you've decided to go ahead and do it, you've got to have the requirements right for the system. And if we look through the archives of the risks cases that I've collected, there are many cases where they didn't get the requirements right in the first place. In the case of say, the Patriot, the requirements said that the system only has to run for 14 hours. And that may be correct for the application that was originally intended, but it might be rather short-sighted if you then decide that you have to run the system for longer periods of time. So it's not just a question of requirements not being correct. It's a question of there being not quite far-sighted enough.
Bound for failure.
Yeah, and we often don't anticipate that once we've designed this wonderful system, it's going to be used for many other purposes. So we tend to design things that are somewhat narrowly conceived, whereas if you'd step back at the beginning and said, well, look, let's generalize a little bit. We can make it more reliable. We can make it more resistant to malicious attack. We can make it able to respond to its own failures and recover from them, and maybe reconfigure itself and wind up still operating properly despite the fact that it's had some serious malfunction.
A better system than it was before.
Yeah, that can be done if you anticipate the need from that from the beginning.
My guest today is Peter Neumann, principal scientist in the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International and author of the column Inside Risks. This is Tech Nation, Americans in Technology, and I'm Dr. Moira Gunn. Let's go to that example you were just talking about in Tehran. What went wrong? The Patriot system was working great, and then one incoming Scud landed on the barracks of GIs.
Well, this is a difficult problem. if you try to place the blame in one place, you find that you can't do it. The blame can be distributed, if in fact you're going to assign blame at all. There was, for example, a government statement that about 95% of the Patriots succeeded in destroying their targets. There was a later study at MIT which claimed that something of the order of 13% actually hit their targets. That was done by Ted Postol at MIT. And so there's a great deal of controversy in the Patriot case as to what actually happened. We still don't really know what went on. But if you try to put the blame anywhere, you can say, well, maybe the 14-hour requirement was a bad thing. That was awfully short-sighted. You can say that whoever designed the software for the clock didn't do a very good job.
And why?
Because it drifted. The clock after 100 hours, which was the case on the Dachan barracks destruction, the clock had drifted so substantially that the Patriot system was no longer tracking the missiles in the appropriate frame of reference that it was using. So there was a very serious problem in the clock. Now, you can say, well, maybe the design was okay, but the implementation was wrong because there was a mistake made in the program where there were two different representations of the same number, say 0.1, which in various representations might not be identical. And the software actually relied on the fact that it was the same number, even though it didn't compare as being the same number. And so the clock was sort of wandering off the mark as time went on.
Well, yeah, let me just interject here. In terms of a clock, I mean, my perception of this is that if your clock is right, you're looking at where an incoming scud is at one point in time mm-hmm. and where it is at another point in time.
Right.
And from that, you can track how fast is it moving and what is its trajectory.
Yes, but
well,
you can also...
You're looking at the clock, and it's not, those aren't the right times. You're going to project it's going to be at another place.
Yeah, it's worse than that. If the difference between two times is not close enough to reality, then you are no longer able to track the incoming missile.
So that if they had simply turned the Patriot systems off and reset them and turned them on again,
that
they might have been all right.
Yeah, that would have helped. But there are other problems as well. And as I say, when you start to assign blame, a lot of these systems are built in a great rush or under circumstances where they don't really have the freedom to do it right. They have to do something quick and dirty to get it going, and then you tend to use that system and modify it a little bit and fix it and then add new functionality to it so that suddenly you're trying to do much more than it was than you'd originally conceived it.
You know, and I'm very aware of you using the words assigning blame because quite often when an engineering system has a problem, I mean, there are things we can't change, how fast a human responds and how fast a human can read and what they can look at. But quite often we can change the core of an engineering system. And too many times I've seen there be a problem, and it's now time to sit down with the engineering group and say, gosh, what went wrong? And then people say, well, there's no point in assigning blame. We don't want anybody feeling bad about that. We've lost the opportunity to learn from the failure. So we really do need, in general, some words here to say we're not looking for blame. We're not looking to pin it down. But if there's something we can do in the technology process, let's find it and not only fix it here, but see if there's a general methodology that we can use to improve it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good comment. If we go back to the Hubble telescope, for example, if there had been an overall end-to-end test of the entire system, that problem with the lens would have been detected immediately. On the other hand, that's a very expensive process. And in engineering, one is always making compromises and trying to take shortcuts that one thinks are still safe or reasonable or sound or whatever. And so it's not always possible to even do the kinds of testing that you'd like to see. There are a lot of environments, the original Star Wars concept, for example, had to work correctly the first time it was ever deployed in an environment where it could never be tested completely. There could be no end-to-end testing of the system. And I think that kind of a system is very risky. It's extremely difficult to know that everything is going to go right. And in fact, the experience of the past says that things are going to go wrong. And Murphy's Law is of course, known to everybody, but it's very, very valid. And if you plan a computerization effort around the assumption that things are going to go well, you're probably in serious trouble.
You know, this does remind me, as we're looking at these systems from a global or a larger level, that some systems basically stand on their own. We have no experience of like systems, but that quite often, as systems are going from either similar type systems or successive generations of systems, that we can, in fact, carry with them some of that experience that's there. An example would be, listeners of this show would have remembered, we spoke with the U.S. Amateur Boxing Association, and if you will remember, we had some American boxers who were shoo-ins for gold medals in Barcelona, and they had a brand new Olympic scoring system, and it didn't work. And in subsequent discussions with them, and they're saying, gosh, how do we find out if it works? How do we figure it out? One of the things that came up is, why don't we take, over the years, the raw data of people pushing buttons, and we know what the answer ought to be, and we'll accumulate the experience of boxing matches in the past, because that's how people box, and that's how people record. So when we have a new system, or a minor change to an old system, a software change that could throw the whole algorithm off, we'll feed in our official set of raw data that says, here's all the old boxing matches, how do you score it?
Yeah.
And you at least know that those kinds of situations, while you haven't hit the whole realm, will be tested. And when you encounter a new one, you can incorporate that as part of your base of knowledge.
It would be nice to believe that one could always do things by hand in a particular situation, and certainly in that case one could. On the other hand, there are a lot of situations where you simply cannot do it by hand. The complexity is too great. But I think there is a deeper problem, and that is, when you design systems like this, you have to come up with a human interface that is, in fact, oriented toward the people who are going to be using it. There was a case of getting back to your boxing analogy, of an ice skating case where the judge actually entered the wrong score, something like 4.1 instead of 5.1.
Yeah.
And there was nothing in the system that permitted that to be corrected, and short of international protest, basically. And so it was simply ignored. But systems should be designed in such a way that you can overcome some of the human error. And in fact, we see that if you include all of the errors in requirements, errors in design, errors in code, those are all human errors. But it's the operational errors that are ones that kill you, unless there's some way of backing off. Now, in banking systems, usually you can, if you have an erroneous transaction, you can back it out and undo it in some way. Not always, but in many cases you can. In life-critical systems, it doesn't work that way.
In the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated category, is this still really happening?
Perhaps the incidence of certain types of problems is diminishing. On the other hand, the incidence of other kinds of problems is increasing. So it really depends on where you look.
My guest today is Peter Neumann, principal scientist at the Computer Science Laboratory at SRI International and author of the column Inside Risks. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. Peter, your first columns, your early columns, primarily reported failures that have occurred and are of general interest. And over time, you began to discuss issues which surround technology. One that is of real interest to me is, you discuss the issue of trust. Who should you trust to do what?
Well, basically, we are implicitly trusting a lot of people to do a lot of things. We're trusting the people who set up the requirements. We're trusting the people who design the system, who implement it, and who operate it. And in some cases, we're trusting the users. Now, in some cases, that trust is totally misplaced. If you build a system and you assume that everybody is honest, you may have some
problems,
surprises. Now, we have to assume somehow that there are some trustworthy people along the way. But if we design systems such that everybody has to be trusted, we're in real trouble. So the problem then becomes to design things in such a way that the trust can be distributed around, so that you're not trusting everybody with everything, and in fact you are giving only a sort of a piece of the trust to certain individuals. Banks recognized this long ago. You don't have one person who can do absolutely anything in the bank. You divide up the responsibilities. You don't have somebody who can authorize a transaction, take out all the money, and have no accountability for it. The real question here is one of accountability. And most of the computer systems today don't have very good accountability. You can't look at it afterwards and say what happened and know what did happen. there's one comment I can make here that relates to the trustworthiness of the underlying system. There's a magnificent example of Ken Thompson's in modifying a compiler in such a way that the next time that compiler was used to recompile the system, there would be a trapdoor installed in the login routine, which would give someone who knew about it essentially unlimited access to the system. Now, this example is absolutely beautiful because it shows that even if you trust all of the code in the original system, this is an example of a Trojan horse that totally undermines all of the security that was in the original system. And yet there was no change, the way this was installed, to any of the source code for the system itself. And this is a miraculously beautiful example of how one could compromise a system completely without there being essentially any evidence that it had happened.
You have observed a growing disillusionment with technology, and in your most recent column, you literally switch the glaring focus off technology itself and onto the interaction between human beings. And having read many of your columns, frankly, it was as if you had a revelation about how we should view technology. Would you talk about that?
In the most recent column, I looked at a book that Jerry Mander has written, which is titled In the Absence of the Sacred, The Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. It's a Sierra Club book. It's a rather extraordinary book. And let's not talk about the sacred part of it. Let's talk about the technology part of it. He makes some very, very strong arguments about essentially looking the gift horse in the mouth. Technology is not a gift horse. In fact, maybe it's a Trojan horse. And what he suggests is that it would be very important to consider whether the use of technology is justified, or whether it's sound, or whether it makes any sense, or whether it is in fact undermining, in some broad sense, the civilization that it is pretending to protect or to help. And I think the issue here is that people often say, well, technology is not intrinsically evil or intrinsically good. It's intrinsically neutral. And I think Jerry Mander's book makes the point that it is inherently evil in the sense that it is so widely misused that its mere existence is more of a problem than it is a blessing. I have a great deal of sympathy for the view that says one must be extremely cautious in using technology. And yet, I'm a technologist, and I derive my livelihood out of trying to build better systems, or to design better systems, or to evaluate systems to see how good they are and how well they meet their requirements. And the conclusion I come to is that, as we started out earlier, there are no guarantees that the system will ever do the right thing. And therefore, we really need to be much more circumspect in applying computer technology and other related technologies in our daily lives, as well as in our the preservation of our civilization, basically.
That was Peter Neumann, a principal scientist at SRI International and author of the monthly column Inside Risks. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for TechNation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.